for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Cold War and its impact on the Middle East has fascinated historian Rashid Khalidi for years. In the 1970s, he taught Soviet and American Middle East policy at the American University in Beirut. It was this experience of the local perspective that prompted him to write about the lasting influence of the Cold War on the present-day Middle East. His new book is titled Sowing Crisis. Rashid Khalidi joins me in the studio. He is the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies, Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. I do look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Diane. Good to be back.
Your argument is that what happened during the Cold War is really still playing out today in the Middle East. In what ways?
Well, in the sense that patterns that developed during the Cold War of seeing a rival as having proxies everywhere. We're now in a mini Cold War with Iran, and very much the same patterns that developed between the United States and the Soviet Union I see are still there in the way we're treating Iran. That's one way in which the Cold War has left over toxic debris, I would
argue. Take us back to that period when the U.S. and Soviet Union were intensely at sort of tooth's edge.
Mm-hmm.
How did the various countries line up with the United States and the Soviet Union? And how did the Middle East get into the middle of that?
Well, at the very beginning, obviously, the Middle East wasn't one of the primary arenas of the Cold War. It was Europe. It was East Asia. But what I show in the book is that very early on, the Middle East came to the attention of policymakers. In fact, during World War II, both the United States and the Soviet Union recognized their energy vulnerability and recognized the strategic importance of the Middle East. And so you had President Roosevelt meeting with Ibn Saud in February of 1945, a mortally ill man on his way back from Yalta, spending a whole day with this minor Middle East potentate. He understood the importance of oil. He understood the strategic importance of the region. Same thing is true of Stalin. He orders Soviet geologists into northern Iran to prospect for oil covertly, never told the Iranians he was doing it. That part of Iran was under Soviet occupation at the time. And that continues through the early years of the Cold War. The two sides came to see the region as more and more important. The Truman Doctrine, the first American doctrinal statement about the Cold War, relates to Turkey, Greece, Iran, and the Middle East. Things didn't harden into the pattern that they had, though, until the 60s, when the Arabs came to be identified with the Soviet Union and Israel, with the United States. And that conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict, came to track very closely with the Cold War rivalry.
So what you're saying is it began with the recognition that energy was going to be at the center
right.
of both entities' interests, but that it came down then to a division, a taking sides
right.
Between what was going on in Israel, what was happening elsewhere in
exactly.
the Middle East.
At the very beginning, the Arab-Israeli conflict did not fall out that way. Both the United States and the Soviet Union supported the establishment of Israel in 1948. And they stayed on the same side, but a different side, during the 1956 war, when both the United States and the Soviet Union opposed Britain, France, and Israel's attack on Egypt. So, strangely, there was no polarization between the superpowers. They were at odds with one another in 48 and in 56. 56, you'll remember, October 56 was the time of the Hungarian uprising and the Soviet invasion and suppression of that uprising. Nevertheless, the two superpowers were, strangely enough, on the same side in both of these episodes, albeit for different reasons. thereafter, in the 60s, this thing came to track along very rigid Cold War lines. Arabs, most of them, with the Soviets, Israel, and some, a few Arab countries with the United States.
Do you see that same division now?
It's a slightly different division, obviously. But my argument in this book is that we've gone from a Cold War against an evil empire to a sort of mini Cold War against what former President Bush called an axis of evil. We've gone from an obsession with communism to an obsession with Islamic terrorism or Islamic radicalism. And there's been very little examination of some of the problems for the region, this region in particular, that that specific obsession created. I think we did very little justice to the specificities of the countries we and the Soviets obviously intervened in during the Cold War with this worry about communism. In the case of the Middle East, an inflated worry of about communism.
As you see it, did the United States have an opportunity during that Cold War period to play out more effectively toward the Arab world? Did it miss that opportunity?
Probably the biggest missed opportunities were, in my view, in the 50s, when under the Eisenhower administration, there was a misapprehension of what Arab nationalism was. And it came to be identified in the late 50s and 60s with communism, and it was really quite different. And there were a whole set of opportunities there that I think were missed. The other opportunities came later, and there were opportunities for peacemaking, together with or separately from the Soviet Union, in the 70s and the 80s. And instead of exerting their energies on resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict, my argument in this book is that both the Soviets and the Americans made this conflict much worse by ratcheting it up through uninhibited arms deliveries, especially the Soviets, but also the United States. We I think, encouraged war rather than making peace. And I came upon an episode in looking at some of the documents in 71 when the Egyptians offered a bilateral treaty with Israel. And Secretary of State Rogers came back and was basically turned down by President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, who said, no, we want to get the Soviets out of Egypt. That's our primary objective. So the Cold War imperatives were more important than peacemaking. I'm sure it was the same. I argue the same was true with the Soviets.
Rashid Khalidi, his new book is titled Sowing Crisis, the Cold War and American Dominance in the Middle East. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. The demise, surely, of the Soviet Union offered at least the United States a clear advantage. What happened?
Well, to their credit, I think that the first Bush administration and Secretary of State Baker in particular did try and take advantage of that. I'm fairly harsh on the last three administrations in arguing that they did not really take advantage of the post-Cold War opportunities in the Middle East. But to their credit, I think that the first Bush administration did try and do that, both in the way that they dealt with Saddam's invasion of Kuwait and in the way they tried to put together a multilateral comprehensive peace negotiation. And they secured an achievement. It's the first and last time anybody brought all the parties to the table, which they did at Madrid in October of 1991. And I think that the end of the Cold War facilitated that. So there were opportunities. After that, I think they tended to, those opportunities tended to be missed.
You talk about the current situation, the so-called Cold War that the United States now faces with Iran. How much of Iran's assistance came into play for the United States in Iran's war with Iraq and Iraq's war with Iran?
Well, one of the points that I make in the book is that in all the major regional conflicts that I treat, Arab-Israeli, Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon, the two superpowers played a not terribly distinguished or noble role, making these conflicts worse. And in the case of Iran-Iraq, it may have been the most shameful, because both superpowers in different ways supported both sides at different times in this conflict. It's almost mind-boggling. And in the shuffle, what got lost were things like the Kurds or the Shia in Iraq or the possibility of ending that conflict. It is not a noble episode for either superpowers. Of course, the advocates of realpolitik say that's the way these things go. But when you look at some of the details, and then you hear the same people getting up on their soapboxes and talking about the Kurds, or talking as Secretary Rumsfeld did about Saddam, and you go and look at the footage of him throwing himself into Saddam's arms during a visit as a presidential envoy in 83, the mind fairly boggles.
So right now, what do you see as the U.S. opening possibility with Iran?
This is not going to be easy. It's going to involve a change in attitude on the part not only of the United States but of the Iranians. It's going to involve dealing with old grievances. It's going to involve dealing with the extremely complex nuclear issue, which is going to mean some kind of very, very difficult negotiation. And it's going to mean a grand bargain in the region, which is going to be a problem for America's allies there.
Don't you think it was interesting to learn President Obama's letter to Foreign Minister Putin on this very issue?
Prime Minister Putin. I think that was interesting, and I think that it was also interesting that the president in his first press conference made a point in response to a question by Helen Thomas about Israel's nuclear weapons that the approach should be a non-proliferation approach, that the United States and the Soviets have to build down their arsenals.
Is that a different response than...
Certainly is. It certainly is, both in terms of seeing non-proliferation overall as important to dealing with the Middle East nuclear issue and as an approach to that issue.
Rashid Halidi, he has a brand new book. It's titled Sowing Crisis. He is the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia University. When we come back, your questions, comments, stay with us. Welcome back. Rashid Halidi is with me. He is at Columbia University. He's written many books. His latest is titled Sowing Crisis, The Cold War and American Dominance in the Middle East. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I remember so vividly after 9/11 occurred, the Bush administration claiming it had the right and obligation to engage in vigorous unilateral actions. How do you think that was received by Russia, the former Soviet Union?
Very negatively, I think. I think Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, Middle Eastern countries, most of them, received this with a great deal of concern because, you know, every country has the right of self-defense under the UN Charter and under any sense of international law. But there are limits on that, and there have been in the past, during the Cold War, for example, there was a sort of a set of understandings about how far you could go. And they developed through conflict, and they developed between rivals. And one of the things that the Bush administration was effectively asserting was the Cold War is over. there is no limit or restraint on American power. We can basically do absolutely anything we want to do. And if international law is a restraint, we simply discard it. If our Constitution is a restraint, we simply discard it. They never said it that blatantly, but that's what they were saying. And I think that concerned a lot of people.
You were actually in Beirut during the 10-week Israeli siege in 1982. Talk about that experience and how that has affected your thinking about what happens in the Middle East.
Well, one of the things that it's given me is a thick skin for criticism. You know, if you've been in a city that was under bombardment, you don't mind being criticized in the Wall Street Journal
and you
or on
have
Fox
been
News.
Criticized a great deal, no question of that.
It also gave me a sense of what it's like to live in a country without any kind of order, in a state of near anarchy, a state of disorder. It gave me a sense of how absolutely imprecise major battlefield weapon systems are. Aerial bombardment is not a very precise art. Bombardment with artillery is even less precise. So when Tom Friedman wrote about an indiscriminate bombardment of West Beirut, he knew whereof he spoke. It's pretty difficult to bombard a city without doing it indiscriminately. So I learned a lot, I suppose. I ended up writing a book about the PLO and that war afterwards.
And now the U.S. is involved in open-ended wars, presumably with some end in sight for Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But what about Afghanistan and back to the Cold War? Exactly.
Right. Well, hopefully an end is in sight in Iraq. And I think that end will be placed on that war by the Iraqis themselves. I think that the Status of Forces Agreement and the treaty that the Bush administration signed, which is very different to what the Bush administration started to negotiate several months before, much more restrictive in terms of what the United States can do and more limiting in how long the United States can stay there, means that that war will end. But Afghanistan, I worry a great deal about. I'm not an Afghan expert, but I know a little history. Alexander the Great, the Tsars, the British Empire, and the Soviet Empire failed miserably in Afghanistan. And as a very smart American civil servant said, we went, Ambassador Charles Freeman, we went to Afghanistan to chastise the people who had attacked the United States and their local helpers. And suddenly, the mission metastasized into state building in a country that probably has never in its entire history had a central state. It's basically an impossible task, or near impossible task. How that happened and why we are there doing that, chasing after people who attacked the United States, perfectly understandable. Self-defense. Would that we had done it more intensively and better, and we might have been out of there. But no, we didn't just go in to chastise and punish and ideally end a threat of terrorism against the United States. We are now engaged in nation building in a country that's never had a modern central government.
Interesting that Congressman John Murtha yesterday said we're going to need at least 500,000 troops.
Well, to do what we say we're going to do.
Afghanistan.
He knows better than I, perhaps, what it would require.
Which is an awful lot more than what President Obama has said the administration plans to send. We have a great many calls. We'll mm-hmm. open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Manassas, Virginia. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Diane. Good morning, Professor Khalidi. This is a tremendous program. My question is fairly simple, and it has to do with the Israeli nuclear program. Mm-hmm. How did Cold War politics relate to the whole concept of nuclear ambiguity? And then the other question is how do we get to where we need to be in terms of a overall agreement in the Middle East? Mr. Blix, Mr. Alberidi, and others have made some very, very strong statements about the necessity of Israel coming clean and putting their mm-hmm. their nuclear program on the table. What do you think the prospects are for that to happen?
I'm glad you've asked me easy, simple, short questions. Well, as far as the Cold War and Israeli nuclear weapons, you can't entirely blame the Cold War for this. This is the French who basically gave the Israelis the wherewithal to develop nuclear weapons. But sadly, under President Kennedy, who was apparently opposed to the idea of Israel developing nuclear weapons, the Israelis essentially deceived the United States and never let it find out exactly what was going on in the reactors where nuclear materials for weapons were being
produced. What evidence do you have for that?
That is the evidence that people like Amnon Cohen has written on the Israeli bomb and other historians have come up with.
And you're suggesting that Israel deliberately deceived the United States.
That's what the evidence seems to show. But more importantly than that, because Israel and the United States came to be much closer to one another in the 60s because of Cold War imperatives, eventually American policymakers just overlooked it. The Israelis pretended they didn't have them. The Americans pretended they didn't know they had them, and that was the way it continued. To get to John's other concern, which I think is really very important, I don't think you're going to be able to deal with Iran's nuclear potential as a military power without addressing some way of Iran getting civilian nuclear capabilities and without addressing the overall issue of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, which is why I refer to President Obama's statement in his press conference about this. I think that's the approach. I think the United States, Russia, other nuclear powers have to commit to building down. I think they have to commit to areas where nuclear weapons could be built by nuclear, potentially nuclear-capable powers like Brazil.
Did you hear that response of his as an indication that that's where he wants to move?
Well, he was answering a question by Helen Thomas about Israeli nuclear weapons.
Know.
And he started talking about nuclear nonproliferation in the Middle East. So unless he was talking about, you know, apples when she was talking about oranges, and to the extent to which he was answering the question indirectly, I read it as his seeing that somehow this is a larger issue than just Iran and its nukes.
All right. To Victor, New York. Good morning, Sandra. Hello. You're on the air.
Yes, Diane. Good morning. Thank you.
Certainly.
You mentioned that the Bush administration post 9/11 effectively said they had no limits on some of the things that they previously had in terms of wiretapping and torture and that kind of thing. And it reminded me a lot of what I learned from Tim Weiner's very extensive history of the CIA. And I wondered if your guest had read that.
I used it for my book, yes.
Pardon?
I used it for my book.
Yeah, it was so... Well, there were times when I just didn't want to read it, but I read it twice. Because
you're a masochist.
I think I'm a glutton for punishment, but if we don't know what was done in our name from post-World War II to today, how can we do anything about it?
Well, sorry, go ahead.
Well, it just reminded me so much of the goings-on, but that wasn't surprising because the people advising Bush were the old Cold Warriors.
Right, right.
So the CIA's activities were well-known to them and acceptable. So my question is, do you think that that will carry over into the new, and I guess more importantly, in the public's mind, has terrorism sort of become the new communism, just the generic boogeyman for anything bad that happens to us?
I mean, I address this point in my book, and I invite you and other listeners to look at an extended discussion of just this point you've raised, of our moving from an evil empire to an axis of evil, and moving from this, I would argue, somewhat exaggerated fear of communism in the Middle East to an exaggerated fear of terrorism in the Middle East. Serious though both were as issues, obviously. And to answer your specific question, will this carry over? We have managed to carry over some very bad Cold War habits, as for that matter have the Russians, it should be said, into the post-Cold War era. And this is the weight of conventional thinking on policymakers. It's easy to blame the policymakers who came in with President Bush. But Democratic policy wonks, the people on whom this administration is drawing for its expertise, carry their share of burdens in terms of conventional wisdom. And I think all of that stuff should really be very rigorously examined.
At the same time, you're not saying, I presume, that we should not in any way be concerned about terrorism.
We should be concerned with a laser-like focus on terrorism, and we should understand that probably the worst way to go after a few thousand people in diffuse terrorist networks is with $60 billion of supplemental appropriations for a war machine that actually is creating terrorists much more effectively than it's killing terrorists. You deal with what is essentially a challenge to your covert capabilities with covert capabilities, not with occupation of countries. It is a uniquely inappropriate metaphor, war, for dealing with terrorism. I mean, you can argue 9/11 was an act of war, but how you go after the people who did it has to be determined by the best way to achieve that goal. And I would argue the best way to achieve that goal was not an invasion of Iraq or the way we've proceeded in Afghanistan.
Well, would you say at this point, going into Afghanistan with special forces, with CIA, would be a better way to go now than with 500,000 troops?
I think that the state-building mission and the anti-terrorist mission should be completely separated. Or I don't think that you should be engaged. The United States should be engaged in Afghanistan in state-building. This is an issue for the Afghans. I hope that the right kind of Afghan state will emerge. But no, I think that the other issues should be dealt with in a very different way.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Umar. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you, sir.
I had a question. If we're so concerned with nuclear proliferation of various nations like Iran and North Korea, mm-hmm. why is it that we don't give them all these alternative energies that seem to be so strongly resisted over here in the United States, put that over there, you know, like wind power, solar power, and so on and so forth, so they don't even have to even, you know, consider nuclear power to so-called
peaceful
help
purposes.
Their country.
Yeah.
You know. You
right.
Understand?
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I myself am not a great advocate of nuclear power, though I spend a lot of time in France, and one of the things I notice is that the French have a very extensive nuclear industry, which appears to be safe, and which has cushioned France, together with hydroelectric and other means that don't rely on oil and gas, from some of the shocks of the world economy and of the oil prices. And I think that you actually have a point with countries like North Korea and to a certain extent, even Iran, which have energy needs that are enormous. Now, Iran has more petrochemicals than most countries in the world, and it could be argued that with proper management of their oil industry, they could deal with their needs. But they, like many countries, feel that they need alternative energies, and maybe the kinds of things that we're talking about for the United States would be a useful option for them.
All right, to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning to your guest.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask a question about the old Soviet Union, Russia / mm-hmm. Putin. He cut his teeth in Afghanistan with the KGB mm-hmm. Back in the 80s, and I still believe he has an eye on a future Soviet Union. I mean, he's certainly a busy man.
Mm-hmm.
My question or comment is that I don't quite understand why Russia and Putin, I do in a way, but why they continue to try to stick their finger or stick their bare head into the hornet's nest there in the Middle East and try to stir it up when it could affect the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do anything but drive the economy down when the price of oil goes way up, mm-hmm. and the chaos that would ensue if Iran or any of the Middle Eastern countries obtained nuclear weapons would be immense. And
mm-hmm.
I know that their oil would go up in price and they would make money on it, but the ensuing chaos in the world would pretty much destroy the world economy. I don't quite understand why they continue to support Iran like that.
Well, a couple things. It's a very interesting question. The first thing is Iran borders Russia, or at least it borders countries that border Russia. It borders former parts of the Soviet Union. The Russians are really not terribly happy about seeing the United States expand its power right up to the immediate borders of Russia. Russia is a country with a history of being invaded by foreign powers. It's therefore acted as an imperialist power, dominating and in many cases occupying and brutally treating its neighbors. And the collapse of the Soviet Union led to that buffer zone shrinking to the point that I think Russian paranoia was once again triggered. And I think that's what Putin represents, a sort of old great Russian reaction to the idea of Russia being encircled.
So back to that letter that the president apparently has written to Putin. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that somebody in the president's circle of advisors is trying to speak to him along these lines and to say to him that the United States can advance its national security interests without stoking Russian paranoia, A, and that dealing with Iran does not require necessarily putting missile interceptors in Eastern European countries that are going to really, in a way that's really going to irritate the Russians, that you can perhaps deal with the Iranian issue and Russia in a shrewder way. It remains to be seen whether this will work, of course.
Exactly. And what do you think Russia's response might be?
Well, I mean, to go back to the questioner, the Russians have a very different view of Iran than we do. They're not terribly afraid of an Iranian nuclear weapon developing as quickly as we are. I agree with the questioner. They may be worried about it, but they don't see this in the same catastrophic light that we do.
Rashid Khalidi of Columbia University. His new book is titled Sowing Crisis. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Nancy and Barry Sanders, helping to secure the future of public radio by supporting both NPR and their own local member station. By the Pew Charitable Trusts, committed to protecting our global marine heritage for future generations at pewtrusts.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Donovan Campbell led a platoon of 40 men in urban combat in Iraq. He says to be an effective platoon leader, you can't think of home, you can't miss your wife, you can only pretend you're already dead, and thus free yourself to focus on your mission and your men. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Campbell about his new memoir. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we'll go right back to the phones to Russell here in Washington, D.C. Russell, your question for Rashid Khalidi.
Good morning, Diane.
Morning, sir.
So Obama in June of last year went before the right-wing Israeli lobby, AIPAC, and he gave them what they wanted. He said that Jerusalem was going to remain the undivided capital of Israel, which is basically saying no two-state solution. And in response, the Arab American community in the United States overwhelmingly, probably over 90%, supported Obama for president.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was delusional. And I'm wondering why, given that there were options, there were people saying, don't support the right-wing militarists, support the peace activists in Israel. People like Ralph Nader were saying that, and he was running for president. I wonder why you and the Arab American community supported Obama.
Well, I never expressed myself one way or another during the campaign, so... I never publicly expressed myself from the beginning of the campaign to the end. Why did the Arab American community support Obama? I suppose because they looked at John McCain and they perceived four more years of the same, and they hoped, perhaps wrongly, that Obama would represent a change. Perhaps they also felt that Ralph Nader didn't have a chance of winning the presidency. And I think that it's an open question about whether he will represent a change. And I think a lot has to do with two communities in this country. One is the Arab American community, finally coming to maturity and operating on a political playing field in a hard-headed way. And that's partly a function of time. I mean, it's still a largely first-generation community. You have people who are not fully assimilated, who don't speak English, who drive down the main street of Paterson or the main street of Dearborn, Michigan, and you will see 300 or 400 shops where the signs are in Arabic. As and when the children of those people go to law school, go to university, understand the Constitution, register to vote, it's a matter of not very many years, and it's already beginning in some places. You will begin to see a shift. And the other community is the Jewish community. 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama. The leadership, the self-proclaimed leadership, the Conference of Presidents, AIPAC, and so forth, represent a position far to the right of John McCain. So the leadership was right-wing Republican. Every position McCain took was very close to AIPAC's positions, whether on Iran, whether on unilateral action, whether on Israel. And yet most people in the American Jewish community voted for Obama. This at a time when he was talked about as a crypto-Muslim. This at a time when scare propaganda was distributed in Florida to retirement homes and so on. And I think what it says is that if that majority of the American Jewish community, which does not, I think, march in lockstep with its self-proclaimed leadership, would assert itself and would free itself of the kind of fear of intimidation, of being seen as being anti-Israel or whatever that the leadership has inflicted on them, you will see the political landscape that would enable the president and the people around him to take some courageous actions. He's a politician in the last analysis. He's one of the smartest politicians of our generation. This is a man who was a state senator in Illinois in 2004, 5 years ago. And here he is, president of the United States. It takes pretty sharp political skills to vault into the most powerful position in the world, and he's not going to do anything that's not politically feasible. And so those of us who think that American policy has not been very intelligent in the last few years have a big responsibility to try and change the political landscape.
All right, to Boca Raton, Florida. Hi there, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you and your guests, both of you. My question is, in 1953, the United States and Britain overthrew Iran's government.
Right.
My question is, why was that decision made? And number two, who made the decision? My other comment is, how do we raise such concern on Iran's nuclear weapons program and not address Israel's?
Right.
Thank you.
Good questions. I actually focus a great deal in the book on that decision in 1953. The British, of course, were involved for very simple reasons. The nationalist, parliamentary democratic nationalist government of Iran, freely elected government under Mohammad Mossadegh, had nationalized Britain's oil interest in Iran after the British refused to share the profits more equitably. And the British were involved in this overthrow for old, naked imperialist reasons. The Iranians said, wait a minute, Britain has just nationalized its railways, its coal industry, its steel industry. Why can't we nationalize our oil industry? And of course, the British would have nothing of it. But the United States acted for different reasons. And I argue that this is another one of the bitter fruits of the Cold War. President Truman had refused to move along with the British. But President Eisenhower, Secretary of State Dulles, Allen Dulles, his brother who had a CIA at that time, were convinced that there was a danger of communist infiltration. They were partly convinced by the British who fed them this line and fell in with this plan. And I think it was disastrous. I think American-Iranian relations have suffered seriously ever since. As far as your other question, I couldn't agree more. The issue of nuclear arms in the Middle East should be treated comprehensively and globally. There are several countries that have the potential to go nuclear, and I think that it ought to be addressed involving a discussion of Israel's very powerful nuclear capabilities.
Here's an email from Roger in Washington, D.C. He's wondering what you think about General Petraeus and his role in helping in Afghanistan.
Well, Iraq got better, mainly because the United States scaled down its objectives and because it stopped fighting the people who were fighting us. And it is to General Petraeus's credit to the extent to which he was involved in that scaling down of American objectives from the idea of keeping bases in Iraq permanently to basically accepting that we're not going to have bases there in a few years, from desiring to have a government there, which very much did what the United States wants, to accepting that it's up to the Iraqis, and so on. And to the extent to which he or others are able to translate those lessons to Afghanistan, and we understand that we probably are not going to be able to create a Jeffersonian democracy, or perhaps even a modern centralized state in a country that's never had either of those things, we might be able to get out of that mess in the way that I hope we'll get out of Iraq.
Here's an email from Jonathan in Baltimore, Maryland, who says, why do you, Diane, not question his premise? He said, we have substituted the Soviet threat for Islamic extremism. Is Islamic extremism not a threat?
Terrorism directed against the United States
is definitely a threat.
Whether by Islamic terrorists or others is obviously a threat. I think it could be debated how that threat should be dealt with, but it is certainly a threat. But Islamic extremism in and of itself in a country where there's absolutely no threat to the United States is a threat to the people of that country. Islamic radicalism is a serious problem for a very large number of countries. In some cases, as I try and argue in this book, the United States fostered that same Islamic radicalism over decades of the Cold War, when the Muslim Brotherhood and the Wahhabi doctrine coming out of Saudi Arabia were seen as reliable foot soldiers in a battle against the Soviet Union, regional communist parties, and radical socialist and nationalist movements. So we inflated those movements over many decades of the Cold War. And the toxic debris of that can be seen in Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which are things that we helped to bring into existence in Afghanistan to destroy and defeat the Soviet Union.
He also goes on to say that you implied we are viewing Iran as a mini-Soviet Union. Is he saying that Hezbollah is not an arm of Iran?
Hezbollah is not an arm of Iran. Hezbollah is an ally of Iran. Hezbollah is supported by Iran. The fact that it is not a simple proxy of Iran involves, a philosophical distinction. We looked at everybody in the Middle East during the Cold War as if they were tools of the Soviet Union. Now, they were sometimes allied with the Soviet Union. They were sometimes doing Soviet bidding. But quite frequently, in fact, most often, that was not the case. And that's not the case with allies and you can call them clients if you want, of Iran, like Hamas and Hezbollah. And that was proven in the case of Hezbollah during the fighting in Gaza, when Hezbollah did not fire a single rocket. A couple of rockets were fired by small groups. Why? Because they're more focused on the Lebanese elections and their own domestic Lebanese concerns than they are focused on any Iranian objective in the Middle East.
All right. To Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Zahir.
Yes, this is Zahir. First time calling. Last time listening. You know, Diane.
Thank you.
Peace be with you. And assalamu alaikum, Dr. Habibi.
Alaikum assalam, Dr. Khalidi.
Dr. Khalid.
Please go ahead with your question, sir.
I have a very short question. It's about Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. What's the foreign policy? Are we staying there forever, or there's any plan for withdrawal?
Well, I don't know the answer to that because I'm not sure that the Obama administration knows the answer to that. All I can say is I hope that we are not, and I hope that there is a plan for withdrawal. But I can't possibly answer that question. I don't think that they know here in Washington, the people who make these decisions.
Here's an email from Bill in Jamestown, North Carolina, who says, I can't sit still and let your guests go unchallenged. When he flippantly states that the Bush administration decided it could do anything it wanted. My opinion is any administration must do anything it can for defense of the country. I don't know where your guest was on that infamous September morning. I was glued to my television praying the Air Force was launching bombers to protect us from those maniacs. It's beyond my belief that anyone could have watched those planes fly into those buildings without developing a sense of rage, not a sense of looking to see where America is wrong and why we deserve to be attacked. What if these people had been in charge when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor?
Well, you have a choice when you're attacked. You can respond stupidly and emotionally out of rage, or you can respond intelligently. Now, let's go back to Pearl Harbor. The United States, in response to Pearl Harbor and in World War II, very specifically directed its strategic bombing at strategic targets. The British, out of rage and anger at the destruction of Coventry and the Blitz against London, restricted their bombing to civilian targets. They thereby prolonged the war in Europe. They bombed Hamburg. They incinerated it. They bombed a number of German... In fact, they bombed every German city down to the size of 50,000 people. And they probably prolonged the war thereby, whereas the United States focused its bombing during the day on strategic targets and measurably shortened the war. So I would argue that rage is a really poor motivation for responding to a threat, a lethal threat, to your national security, whether it's on the level of Pearl Harbor or whether it's on the level of 9/11.
Do you think that had the U.S. contained its focus to Afghanistan, we could have found the people who carried out this?
I can only wish that we had tried. The rage that the caller talks about was exploited and manipulated by the Bush administration to evade a country that had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11, causing the deaths of 4,200 American servicemen and women. That was a colossal error, and it grew out of the cynical, cold manipulation by the previous administration of understandable rage on the part of American citizens at seeing thousands of their fellow citizens incinerated in New York or in Washington.
Where were you then?
I was in Chicago that morning, watching in horror and shock. My concern is that those who attacked us have, in effect, gotten off scot-free because the rage of people like the caller was manipulated by cynics in the last administration.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And finally, a caller in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Jose. You're on the air.
Good morning. After studying American foreign policy for over 30 years, I have come to the sad conclusion that there are two camps disguised in sophistication. One that blames America for everything in the world, and the other one that sees America as the savior of all humanity. I was very excited to hear this title and this book, and I will still get it because I'm a student of the subject. And so, therefore, I must make an effort to read all of this. However, from the conversation of the professor in your show, I'm a little bit dismayed because I think it tends to fall in the first camp. The situation is not as simple as it may seem. First of all, I haven't heard one answer from him as to how tactically and strategically he would have removed the Taliban and al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan without military intervention. Secondly, he blames the United States for nation building. What would have been the charge against the U.S. if the U.S. had just gone to remove the Taliban and al-Qaeda and left the country without being rebuilt? That's another issue. The thing is, the other thing is, he ends up where he begins, unfortunately, which is blaming the Bush administration, saying that what he was just charged by the last caller or email, and admitting that the administration did not put it exactly that way, but leaves the categorization standing anyway. However, his book is very well intended if it would bring us into the whole framework of the context of the Cold War, which is still with us, and now it's in more than ideological war, it's a nationalistic war, where the Soviet Union has always had interest ever since the 1800s
to control
Afghanistan.
All right, sir.
Jose,
thanks for calling.
I don't know how much time I have. Let me just say, I hope you do read the book. This is not a matter of blaming. This is a matter of looking coldly at things that I think were terrible mistakes in terms of American national interests. Yes, you had to go after the people who attacked the United States. Does that involve restructuring the entirety of Afghanistan? I don't think that's doable, and I don't think it's something that we needed to do in order to attack the people who attacked us. Now, the Taliban didn't attack us. They were the enablers of al-Qaeda, and something had to be done about that. But I do not think that going after the people who attacked us necessitated many of the things that we did. I don't think that that's a matter of blaming America. That's a matter of blaming what I think is mistaken foreign policy of the previous administration.
And finally, you dedicate the book to your newborn grandson,
right,
hoping that he'll grow up to see peace in the Middle East. Are you optimistic that that might be there?
I'm optimistic that it's possible. I hope it will be. He's 8.5 months old, And I sincerely hope that he will see a better part of that part of the world in a better state when he gets to my age than it is today.
You seem to imply it is going to take yet another generation.
I'm not sure that that's the case. I think we could make some big strides in the next few years. It's perfectly possible to achieve American national interests and resolve some of these conflicts and reduce the dangers to the United States and to make the lives of people better in that region.
Rashid Khalidi, he is the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies, Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. His new book is titled Sowing Crisis, The Cold War and American Dominance in the Middle East. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.